This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this Memorial Day, we're going to hear from a Marine colonel who for 3 years had the job of delivering the news that every military family dreads. Families knew what to expect when they saw him coming. A loved one had been killed in Iraq. But his job didn't end with that awful message. He helped the families get through the terrible period that followed. Beck was a major at the time. He's a colonel now. Colonel Beck is my guest, along with journalist Jim Sheeler. Sheeler's new book, Final Salute, is about Beck, the families he notified, and the loved ones they lost. Final Salute is an expansion of Sheeler's Pulitzer Prize-winning article, which he wrote for the Rocky Mountain News, where he spent 5 years covering the impact of the Iraq War at home. He begins teaching journalism at the University of Colorado in the fall. When I recorded this interview with Sheeler and Beck last month, Beck was on a brief leave to enable him to go on a book tour with Sheeler. My first question was for Colonel Beck. In the 3 years that it was your job to knock on doors and deliver the news that someone's loved one had died in the war, did you learn what were the best ways of breaking the news, like phrases that you could use that would maybe soften things a little bit or convey the kind of emotion that you, or lack of emotion that you felt you needed to convey?
That's a very tough question. I don't know that I learned how to do that. I don't believe I learned how to take away emotion of the most horrible news that can be delivered to someone. It is wrought with emotion. What you must do is convey to them that their loved one has fallen, their loved one has died, and that you're there, that you have empathy for their pain, and you're there to care for them and to help guide them through what will prove to be some of the most difficult days of their lives. And so you go with an empathetic heart, but at the same time, you go standing as strong as you can so that you can be their oak and they can lean on you in the times that will come, which will be some of the most difficult times for them.
Being there to lean on is actually part of the job. How long are you expected to remain close to a family and be there to support them?
I don't think we have established a set time for that. That really comes down to the relationship that is formed between a family and a casualty officer or a fellow Marine. They know you're a Marine. They know you're trying to take care of them. They know you're there for them. If relationships form between casualty officers and family members, they could last for years. Or if they don't form in those times of adversity that they're going through, they may dissolve when your duty is completed and you've taken care of the family as much as you can.
Do the families often know what the news is going to be as soon as they see you?
I think so. It's my belief that when they see us at the door, that they know that something bad has happened. And they all know that their loved one's serving in combat, and we just don't go make house visits. So if we're standing in there in front of their door, I think they always know that something very bad has happened.
Yeah, they're instructed in their this is Jim. They're instructed before their service member leaves that if their loved one is injured, then they'll get a phone call. And the only way that they will know that if they've died is that if they get a personal visit. And I mean, I've talked to mothers and wives who, I mean, they'll circle the street two or three times, just kind of eyeing in front of their house, looking for that government van, looking for things that aren't right, because they know that if it's there, then the worst has happened. And they try to put it off as much as they can, put it out of their minds, but it's always there.
You're there in part to help the person to whom you're delivering the news. You're there to deliver it and to help them. But when they see you and they figure out why you're there, you're the symbol of the worst thing that could happen. And I guess I'm wondering what it's like to knock on a door knowing that you are going to initially be that symbol.
Well, the way I've come to terms with that, for me, for personally, I know that I'm delivering the worst news that they could possibly hear. And it's incredibly painful for me. But what drives me forward is knowing this the pain that they're going to go through cannot even possibly be compared with the minimal pain and discomfort I'm feeling. And so I can put mine aside quite easily, knowing that the pain I'm about to cause with this news and my responsibility to them, America, to take care of that family is more important than any discomfort that I have.
Jim, you write about how Marines always go out in pairs when they're delivering the bad news. Why are there two Marines going to each home?
Well, there's usually the casualty assistance calls officer plus a chaplain. I mean, nobody knows how somebody's going to react to that news. And I think they've decided that having two people there is the best way to do it. The Marines actually do it different than the Army. In the Army, they have someone who will knock on the door, and that's pretty much his job, is to deliver the news, and the family never sees him again or her again. With the Marines, that person that delivers the news is the primary casualty assistance calls officer, and they're there for the rest of the whole process.
Well, grief has many faces, and when someone's getting this shock, they respond differently, and so anger should be expected and planned for. I felt all the different emotions that they were feeling at the time, and I know the reality of it is that I'm not the person they really want to lash out at, but I'm certainly don't mind being that person because they need to do that. They need to do that with someone, and it's better that it is me than, or the casualty assistance calls officer than in someone else and their family or otherwise, or themselves for that matter. So taking that on is not something that we're concerned about, but we go out together. And we have a chaplain with us as well. So I think we're with another Marine and a chaplain. I don't think we can go wrong.
Jim, one of the stories that you tell in your book is the story of Catherine Caffey, who lost her husband in Iraq while she was pregnant. And it was Colonel Beck who had to deliver the news with her and who stuck with her during this horrible part of her life. Would you describe the story as you understand it of how she responded when Colonel Beck came to the door?
Sure. Catherine was actually taking a nap when they knocked at the door. And her stepfather answered. And as soon as he saw the Marines there, he knew. And then he stepped back, and Catherine's mother saw them, and she screamed. And then he went in to wake up Catherine, who had heard the screaming of her mother. And she asked what had happened, and he just said, "It's not good. You need to come outside." And as soon as she saw Major Beck and the chaplain there, she knew as well. And she started screaming. And she screamed and screamed. And she ran into the other room, cradling her pregnant, belly. And she just glared at the Marines from the way she and her parents and Major Beck describe it. And she just went and took a bath. And she sat there for a long time before she came back out. And a lot of the families have that sort of reaction of sometimes they refuse to let the Marines in, period. They say, if I don't let them in, it's not going to happen. They'll try and delay the message. But eventually, it always gets to them.
My guests are Colonel Steve Beck and journalist Jim Sheeler. For 3 years, Beck had the job of notifying families that their loved one had been killed in Iraq and then helping the families through the tough period that followed. Sheeler's new book, Final Salute, is about Beck, the families he notified, and the loved ones they lost. One of the people Sheila writes about is Catherine Cathy, who learned from Colonel Beck that her husband Jim was killed in Iraq. She was pregnant when she got the news. Her husband's casket arrived from Iraq on a commercial airline, an American Airlines flight that landed in the Reno Tahoe International Airport. Colonel Beck, were the passengers on the flight aware that there was a fallen Marine in the cargo?
They were. What we often try to do, it doesn't always happen, but we try to make sure that we, through the help and the assistance of the airlines, we'll communicate. At least it was something that I like to do every opportunity that I had with a particular airline was to let them know, to radio ahead to the pilot and ask them to ask the passengers to remain seated while we took care of our fallen Marine. And so my understanding is they were able to do that on this particular flight. They did also know that point in the war, many people realize that when there's a service member in a dress uniform on board that they may be transporting someone home. So in this particular instance, the pilot made an announcement and asked everyone to remain seated and just as we would like and show their respects as we bring our brother home.
And Jim, you write in your book that commercial flights aren't used anymore in this way. Why did that change?
A father in California complained after learning that his son would come home on a commercial airline. And since then, Congress has passed a measure that allows the families to choose whether they want their sons to come home or sons and daughters to come home on commercial flights or on private chartered aircraft, which in some ways is better for the family. And they've also instituted a rule that those caskets are to be met by a full honor guard and given the proper treatment.
There's an incredibly moving photo of Catherine, who was very pregnant at the time of her husband's death, draping herself over his coffin. Jim, I know you didn't take the photographs for the book, but did you and the photographer ever feel like it was intrusive of you to be there observing or photographing this period of grief?
Well, the photo was taken by Todd Heisler, who now works for the New York Times. When we first met Catherine, it was in her home a few days after her husband's death. And she, like all the other family members, just simply wanted to talk about her husband. She wanted to tell Jim's story. And I've found this continually. It doesn't matter anybody's politics. The family wants their son or daughter's picture on the front page of the paper next day. They want their stories told. And so we sat with Catherine for hours just talking and talking. And the one thing that really struck me was she told the story of how when they found out she was pregnant, that she took up knitting because Jim was in officer candidate school at that time. And she would knit and knit. And when she found out the baby was coming, she started knitting baby blankets and baby booties. And the night before Jim left for Iraq, he slept with that baby blanket, and he did it because he knew he wouldn't be home in time to see the baby born. But when the baby was born, he wanted the baby to know how he smelled. And for me, that really said all that needed to be said about Jim Cathy as a person. And we also made a connection with Catherine. After spending hours with her during one of the worst times of her life, when we left that night, she said, thank you. You know, this may sound strange, but you guys made my night. Because we were able to take Jim's story and share it with so many people. And so when we got to Reno, it was basically the most difficult question that I had to ask in the whole reporting process was to ask Catherine if we could come along for everything, for the entire process. By this time, we had been following Major Beck for about 9 months. And but we hadn't seen everything from the inside, you know, through the family's eyes directly. And so I asked her if we could come along for everything. At that point, I probably knew more about what was going to happen than she did. But I told her that if there's ever a moment that you feel like we're getting too close, we're too intrusive, all you have to do is just wave your hand and look at us funny and we're gone. And I think by giving her that power, she realized that she didn't have to use it. It kind of created this trust that remained throughout the entire process. The night that she was sleeping with Jim's casket there, she decided to sleep with Jim's casket the very last night he was there. And at one point, just before she fell asleep, she looked up at one of the Marines who was looking over Jim's casket, and she said, "Are my reporters still here?" And he said, "Yeah, you want me to get rid of them?" And she said, "No, no, I just wanted to know that they were still here." So we were comfortable that she was comfortable with us being there and that she wanted people to see what she was seeing.
Colonel Beck, one of your jobs is to inspect the body in the casket before the family comes in and sees the body. What are you looking for in this final inspection?
Well, warfare is is the most violent place and conditions that there are on Earth. Things happen to people that can devastate their bodies. And so it's important that we make sure that nothing has happened in transit with the airlines. And it's important that we make sure that the uniform on the Marine is perfect and so that we can convey to the family exactly what they may see if they desire to look at their loved one one final time. And so if we don't inspect that Marine, we won't understand how best to convey that information to the family so that they can make an informed decision on what their wishes might be with respect to seeing their loved one.
Jim, you've attended about a dozen Marine funerals as part of your reporting and your research for the book. As an outsider, as a person who's a reporter, not a Marine, what did you find most interesting or most confusing to you about the actual Marine funeral rituals?
I think the most amazing things are the things that you don't see, the things that are happening behind the scenes. Yes, there's the very formal and very important ceremony where the Marines are folding that flag for the last time that so many people have seen. But at the same time, a lot of times the Marines will go to the houses, the homes of the relatives or the family members and station themselves at the house because they know it's been in the paper that this family's not going to be at the house. So they want to have that covered, that nobody's going to rob that house, that this family's going to be taken care of. One mother just told me, the Marines are everywhere right now. You don't even know where they are. And so I've made it my job to try and find out. And it was pretty amazing to find out that the escort who brought that Marine home is there and will not leave the casket unattended. And the Marines themselves will not leave that casket anywhere where the public can get anywhere near it. There's going to be two Marines standing at the head and the foot of their brother. And just that dedication is pretty amazing. Some of the Marines that I talk to will, while they're standing post there, they'll talk to the body, even if they never knew him. They'll talk to him when they come up into the airplane and say, hello, you know, you're home. They take this very personally. And when you talk to them about the impact, it's pretty incredible. You know, they're trained to kill, really. I mean, they're trained to fight, and they know how to fight as good as anybody in any branch of the service. And yet, when you talk to them about these emotions when they pick up that casket, you know, one of them told me that you don't know, you don't understand until you pick up that casket and you feel the weight. That's when you understand.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Colonel Steve Beck and journalist Jim Sheeler on this Memorial Day edition of our show. For 3 years, it was Colonel Beck's job to notify families that a loved one had been killed in Iraq and help the families through the terrible period that followed. Sheeler has written a new book called Final Salute about Beck, the families he notified, and the loved ones they lost. Final Salute is expanded from Sheeler's Pulitzer Prize-winning article, which was published in the Rocky Mountain News, where he spent 5 years covering the impact of the war at home. When we left off, Sheeler was describing Marine funerals he attended. Colonel Beck, where were you at the funerals for the loved ones of the people who you were working with after delivering the news?
I'm the person that delivers the flag to that family. And so I am running the ceremony at the funeral. So I'm in charge of that ceremony. And so that funeral, that flag is folded by the Marines, the pallbearers there, and who carried him or her. And they fold that flag, as Jim said, for the last time. And the rifle detail puts three of the brass rounds from the rifle salute into the final fold of that flag, and they present that flag to me to present to the family.
What are some of the things you know that families have done with the flag?
Well, it varies. I've seen flags framed and prominently displayed on mantles. I've seen flags framed and displayed within other cases with all of their loved ones' Marine Corps items around it, basically paying honor to his service or her service. I've seen flags placed in drawers as keepsakes because it's not that they don't want to see them, they just want to protect them and keep them in a very secret place. That's the extent of it. I haven't seen much else.
A lot of the families will, I think I've seen this especially with families with sons who were not married and still have their childhood room. That room turns into a virtual shrine to these guys. With everything they've received, it's pretty amazing what the country has done. Also, kind of behind the scenes, there's a group that sends a quilt to every family. There's a guy that draws a pretty incredible portrait of every service member who's died and just sends it to the family. Mm-hmm. They get stuff from everywhere, just condolence letters, piles of condolence letters, and they save them. And a lot of time they turn into these shrines, these boyhood rooms.
Colonel, are you still in touch with Catherine?
Sure.
How long ago did her husband die?
Gosh. 4 years.
So that says something about the commitment that you make to a family after delivering the news.
These families mean a great deal to me, and they all have a very special place in my heart, I hope I have one in theirs, and they're part of my family, so that's how I view them.
You know, I'm wondering, like, when you train to be a Marine, you're training to survive war and to be able to kill your enemy. When you're dealing with families on the home front, delivering the news that their loved one has died, and then being there to support the family through this horrible period in their lives, it's such a different set of emotions and skills and parts of yourself that you must have to draw on. Were you prepared for that? I mean, do you know what I'm saying? It's like being a Marine in war is so completely different than having to be with somebody while they're grieving and be there for them.
I completely understand. One of the things that Jim said and that you've just repeated was that, you know, Marines are trained for war, they're trained to kill. That's certainly true. We're very good at that. The counter argument is were extremely good at saving lives and taking care of people. The saying, no better friend, no worse enemy, certainly holds true for all Marines. So we're as adept at protecting lives and taking and saving lives as we are at taking them. So, and as defenders of this country and democracy and freedom, I think that that's exactly what you want.
Is it fair to say, because this is the impression, one of the impressions I took away from the book, that you both feel that Americans have been very protected from the realities of the war in Iraq, that the men and women fighting in Iraq and their families and loved ones have paid a huge price, are making incredible sacrifices, but that the majority of Americans have been protected from those sacrifices and haven't been really called on to make sacrifices. Am I interpreting that correctly? And if so, would you elaborate on your concerns about that?
Well, I think the sacrifice is the right word. I've especially seen it in the, you know, the homes of these wives and widows who've, you know, the stories come out in the beginning, and you know, the first funeral we had in Colorado, thousands of people lined the streets, and now, unless it's a smaller town, really the turnout is relatively small. You know, you see that name go across the TV screen, and you know, for anybody who's had any involvement in the process, it weighs so much heavier. I mean, that name is going to affect tens, if not hundreds, of people. Including the service member who just got that cell phone call and had to go knock on that door, which could be happening right now. And the people, there's so many people in this country that live with that realization that that knock could be coming anytime. And yet they go and they do their jobs and they take their kids. The kids are trying to make it through school. I mean, I interviewed a girl who got in trouble, sent to the principal's office for writing on the bathroom mirror in lipstick, "What do you do when your mom's in Iraq?" You know, there's these little scenes that are happening everywhere. And just helping people understand that there is a war going on. I think that there's no family out there who would be against that.
Jim, you're a young journalist at kind of the beginning of your career. And you've spent, you know, 5 years writing about fallen soldiers and fallen Marines and their families. And you've written a lot of other obituaries as well. One of the stories you tell is about a Marine who'd been a gravedigger at Fort Logan Cemetery, a military cemetery. And he had been promoted to a supervisory position. Now, he had been sent to Iraq, and when he got back, suffered a terrible depression. It sounded like he was nearly suicidal. And you write about how the place that he seemed to feel most comfortable was working in the cemetery. Would you talk a little bit about what he told you about that?
Sure. His name is Andrew Alonzo, and he's a reservist who saw one of his really good friends die in Iraq and came back and had a really hard time. He was actually a caretaker at the cemetery when he was called up to go to Iraq. So he had been burying mostly World War II veterans, Vietnam veterans, and then he came back after Iraq and was basically in charge of setting the headstones for the newest active duty, especially the Marines who were coming back. And he had an incredibly hard time with it in the beginning, but then he realized that being that last person to take care of those guys was actually a very cathartic thing for him, that he could make sure that they were cared for. And as we were standing there, as one of the Marines was being buried, he kind of stood off on the side, and after the family left, I asked him what he would have said to her. And he said he felt awkward going up and talking to her, but if he would have could have talked to her, he would have told her that it's okay. We'll take care of him now.
Colonel Steve Beck and journalist Jim Sheeler. Sheeler's new book is called Final Salute. You can download podcasts of our interviews on our website, freshair.npr.org. Our book critic, Maureen Carrigan, has put together a list of nonfiction books she recommends for summer reading. Waterfalls, Wizards, Boys with Red Wagons, and Knights in White Satin jostle for attention on the list. Here's her recommendations.
When I was a kid, family vacations took place in the dead of winter, not summer. My dad was a refrigeration mechanic. His job was to maintain those huge air conditioning units you see on the roofs of tall office buildings. Naturally, summer was his busy time, so it was in that holiday week between Christmas and New Year's that he, my mom, and I would pile into our Rambler Classic and go off on a road trip. Washington, D.C., Williamsburg, Virginia, Mystic, Connecticut, and Niagara Falls. I remember tramping around all those places on overcast, icy days. And now Ginger Strand's new book casts another pall over my childhood vacation memories. One of the facts about Niagara Falls that Strand highlights in her idiosyncratic cultural history called Inventing Niagara is that since 1950, the volume of water that tumbles over the falls roughly doubles during the summer tourist season, from about 50,000 cubic feet of water per second to 100,000 cubic feet per second. During the blah winter season, Canada and the U.S. divert water from the falls as a source of hydroelectric power. So the falls I dutifully stared at on a winter's day were a falls with the faucet turned halfway shut. Strand's book is a kick, illuminating and inflected with her wry voice. A self-proclaimed hydro geek, Strand says that she became obsessed with Niagara Falls because it's a monument to the way America falsifies its relationship to nature. If you just think of Niagara as a Viagra-enhanced has-been honeymoon destination, Inventing Niagara will alert you to the torrent of other meanings Americans have poured onto the spot. I don't remember spending a lot of time looking at the passing scenery on those long-ago vacation car rides. My head was usually buried in a Nancy Drew mystery. If you want to revisit some beloved books of childhood and learn a lot about the history of children's literature in America, Minders of Make-Believe is the substantive tome to dip into. Written by Leonard S. Marcus, who's a prominent scholar of children's lit, Minders of Make-Believe takes readers from the first children's book to originate in the New World, the New England Primer of 1689, up to the Harry Potter phenomenon. Throughout, Marcus traces the tussle that's been going on for over three centuries over whether tykes and teens should be reading books primarily for entertainment or for erudition. While we're on the subject of children's lit, I've just got to wedge one fiction recommendation into this nonfiction roundup. HarperCollins has just reprinted Don Robertson's 1965 young adult novel, The Greatest Thing Since Sliced Bread. That it is. The multi-layered story is set in 1944 when a nine-year-old named Morris Byrd III decides to walk across Cleveland pulling his little sister in a wagon. Morris wants to find his old friend, Stanley Chalupka, who's moved across town. Unfortunately, it's the day of the East Ohio gas explosions, an actual disaster that killed 130 people and destroyed 1 square mile of Cleveland. Both the disaster and its chronicler, Don Robertson, have faded from memory. But with the boost of this reprint featuring wise child Morris, who worships both Veronica Lake and FDR, a whole host of new readers will be ushered back into this lost world. For a generation of kids who came of age in the 1960s and 70s, summer memories are suffused with the tinny sound of rock and roll playing on transistor radios. In her eccentric new memoir, The Importance of Music to Girls, British writer Lavinia Greenlaw writes about the way music, especially rock, propelled her into her first experience of puppy love with Donny Osmond, and later Clash and Banshee-inspired punk rebellions. Greenlaw is gifted with a sharp eye for the deeper significance of the ephemeral. Here, for instance, is how she describes a street scene of her youth. To be a teenager in 1970 was to suffer an excess of gravity. I watched them move slowly along Camden High Street, boys and girls alike with faces half closed behind long center-parted hair. The shape their clothes made was that of something being pulled down into the earth. Scoop-neck tops and flared ankle-length skirts and trousers made of cumbersome corduroy. Their colors were vegetal, umber, ochre, aubergine, mushroom, sage. They looked damp. Boy, does that paragraph bring back the teenage glums of the 1970s. Whether you're traveling this summer, or as my family once did, you find yourself stuck in place, any of these provocative books offer a lot to think about and maybe dredge up a few things you'd rather forget.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Sometime this summer, she'll do a roundup of biographies and books of narrative history. A new box set of five famous movies starring Joan Crawford has just been released on DVD. But classical music critic Lord Schwartz says that one of those films, which he's wanted to see for years, is probably famous for the wrong reasons.
A new DVD has been making me think about the connection between the way performers look and the way they sound. Because of the way music gets recorded on film, most of the singing in movie musicals is pre-recorded and lip-synced by the star miming the motions. If it's the right voice, the dubbing can be electrifying. Rita Hayworth's mock striptease to Put the Blame on Mame in the film noir Gilda became her iconic image even though she didn't actually sing the song. She was lucky that her singing voice belonged to the wonderful Anita Ellis, who sounded as glamorous and witty as Hayworth looked. Marnie Nixon's ladylike, trained operatic voice, complete with British accent, was the perfect counterpart for Deborah Carr in The King and I. But in My Fair Lady, all the character drained from the songs when Nixon sang for Audrey Hepburn, whose own voice was so distinctive and endearing. The musical melodrama Torch Song, starring Joan Crawford, not known for her singing, has just come out on DVD. Crawford plays a hard-bitten Broadway musical star. But she was not as lucky as Rita Hayworth. The uncredited singer dubbing her voice has some of the hard-edged qualities of Crawford's speaking voice, and Crawford's lip-syncing is quite expert. But how could this possibly be the voice of a character who is idolized for her singing?
Diamond starlight in your eyes. I'll take you places on a cloud of gold, and in your arms you'll hold a paradise. My smile will beckon you to follow me.
The most poignant item on the Torch Song DVD is a bonus feature, a half-hour audio clip of an excruciating recording session in which Crawford actually tries to sing her own number. She had once taken lessons from the great American soprano Rosa Poncel, but she can barely hit the notes or stay in tune.
2541, take six.
Follow me, and
And you'll have diamond starlight in your eyes. I'll take you places on a cloud of gold. And in your arms you'll hold a paradise. My smile will beckon you to follow me, and you will know the glow of ecstasy. You'll own the sun, the moon, the stars above. A world of love, if you will always follow me.
Any good?
There are a number of reasons Torch Song wasn't a hit. How could audiences be expected to accept Joan Crawford as a singer or dancer? In 1953, she still had great legs, and when she played flappers in the 1920s, she could really shake them. But she's almost as klutzy a dancer as she is a singer. Torch Song is probably most notorious for a preposterous production number called Two-Faced Woman, in which Crawford actually performs in blackface and dark body makeup. We can finally howl at this legendary camp classic in all its terrible, widescreen technicolor tastelessness.
I can't help being a two-faced woman. A little bit of boldness, a little bit of sweetness, a little bit of coldness, a little bit of heatness. Don't fall in love with a two-faced woman. I'm giving you a warning, I'll leave you in the morning. Got another lover undercover. I'm like a weather vane that goes with the breeze. My disposition makes me do as I please. That's why they call me...
Torch Song is actually a fast-moving soap opera about how a self-centered Broadway diva finds love with a blind ex-soldier and former theater critic, played by Michael Wilding, who was still Elizabeth Taylor's husband at the time. The film is smartly directed by Charles Walters, a dancer-choreographer who directed such entertaining musicals as Good News and Easter Parade. In the movie's most ironic scene, Walters himself plays Crawford's dancing partner, and she wants him fired because he trips over her when they're rehearsing a number. Torch Song is great fun to watch, but it's even more fun when it's bad than when it's good.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and co-editor of the new Library of America volume of Elizabeth Bishop's poems, prose, and letters. We'll close with a track from a new CD by Catherine Russell. I just recorded an interview with her that we'll hear soon.
So little time, so much to do. There's so little time for dreams to come true. Many a ship to sail, many a magic land, many a moonlit trail, many a road to walk hand in hand. There are songs of love we never have sung. Let's not waste them now. So little time.